11 o'clock. We'll get started. I have apologies for Councillor Coventry, Devinck, Montgomery and Young. The order of business will change around slightly. I'm going to take 4.6 education to allow the head of education to get away to another meeting first today. Is there any declarations of interest? Okay. We'll now move on and we'll move straight to Grace. Thank you.
Thank you, and for moving the agenda around. We're in the process of undergoing a lifelong learning and employability CLD inspection this week, so I really appreciate this going first. The quarter one report outlines and almost restates our strategic direction, and this is our commitment to creating a world-class education system and using the concept of how we're moving from good to great. But fundamental within that is the holistic approach of both excellence and equity being part of the same whole. So that's really, really important to us moving forward. When we came back after the holidays, we launched the Uplifting Leadership Programme with all of our heads, and we also offered that out to any interested principal teachers and deputes, and we were staggered to get over 70 people coming in their own time to partake in the Uplifting Leadership Programme. So we're starting to grow really important networks where practitioners are getting together in order to share their own practice. So we're really excited about that, including the Primary One Teachers Network that have been tasked with closing the gap by the end of P1, because we spoke about that. If we can close the reading and writing gap by the end of P1, we know we can make a fundamental difference. It was really interesting as well, because we've based that leadership programme on a recent book published by Professor Andy Hargreaves, who is one of the experts that's been brought in by the Scottish Government to look at education. And he tweeted Midlothian to say good luck with the programme, but he also copied in John Swinney. So it was lovely for us to be up there again and spreading that news about what we feel is really important. We know that leadership makes a difference, and it's important for us to put an awful lot of work into not just the leadership of our head teachers but everybody within the system. And we've also offered that out to everybody within lifelong learning and employability, so Annette's grade 8s are going to come and be part of that forum as well. And that's really important, because we know we can't close the gap on our own. We need that to be a total Midlothian approach to that. In terms of early years, we were growing that. We had the opening of the Woodburn Hub. We've also had really good meetings with the Scottish Future Trust and the Scottish Government on growing that, because we know our ambition is to deliver the 1140 hours by the year 2020. In terms of sustained destinations, before the summer holidays, on the last week of term, we had that published figure, 3% increase in sustained destinations. So we know it's one task to get people into an initial destination, but to sustain that is quite a challenge. We wanted to make sure that we had the right supports in place, and we're really pleased that actually last week the new participation measure snapshot was also published, and that takes in 16, 17, 18 and 19 year olds, so some of our hardest to reach, and comparing last year's snapshot with this year, that was up 4.6%. For that, it's important to realise that we're still below the national average. We're now above it for our school leavers, which is great, and we know that there's a job of work going on. We track that weekly, and this week we're up at 91%, so we know we're making an absolute difference. So it's not about planning just for the uplift in the snapshot, it's about us tailor making that week by week in that one size fits one approach, so we can see that's beginning to work on the ground. In terms of the Children and Young People's Act, just one change to this quarter report. Obviously we had the judicial review of the named person. So although we'll continue with the training, we will not be implementing the named part of that in line with the information that's come back to us from the Scottish Government. So that was not going ahead in terms of the sharing of information from the 31st of August itself, hence linked to the CMIS modules and so on. In terms of emergent challenges and risks, it would be fair to say that education is a very fast-paced, moving feast at the minute. We've had lots of publications over the summer holidays. John Swinney published the delivery plan for Scottish education called Excellence and Equity. We feel that we're on the front foot of that, because obviously that was part of our Closing the Gap, Creating a World-Class Education Service that we launched in August of the previous year. And everything within that we have embedded within our structures moving forward. The 21st of September is the uplift for the secure and teacher numbers. We're absolutely committed to making sure that we attract the very best teachers to Midlothian. And Nicola and Julie, two of my school group managers undertook interviews just at the beginning of term there. We managed to secure another 6 additional permanent supply teachers. So we were really pleased to get applications at that time of year because they're scarce on the ground. So we hope that all of the tweets and all of the word about Midlothian not just being a great place to grow but being committed to world-class education is going to attract some of the best practitioners to come to work here. The new Education Act, we're currently awaiting further guidance around that, but in terms of the National Improvement Framework, the 31st of August was our deadline to submit the Curriculum for Excellence levels, and that was data that was uplifted for every single child across the whole of Scotland, and we've created the dashboard. So I now know, for example, that within P1 there are 16 children in Midlothian within SIMD1. I know that I can track that in terms of reading and writing, and that's really important to me as a head of service, that I know that the interventions that we've planned are making a difference, and if we find that we're not, we stop doing it and we do something that is going to make a difference. So the dashboard and that use of intelligent technology to help heads who are very, very busy to see that just at a glance will help us moving forward. So at the minute that's just at the centre, so the idea is to roll that out to all heads moving forward, and when we came back for our first session with heads, we let them see the dashboard and they were really quite excited about that. We have our first heads conference tomorrow, and Sir John Jones is going to be leading that conference, and that's important for us because moving forward we're also going to be launching an inclusion review, because we need to make sure that we actually deliver for every single child in Midlothian and that every child matters and not only can achieve but can also exceed their potential. So it's been a positive start, but we know that we don't want to rest on our laurels at all. We had the very positive Mayfield inspection, so we know in our areas of multiple deprivation we can make a difference. We need to grow that now so that we deliver that consistently across the piece, and we're not there yet, but we've got plans to make that happen.
Thanks, Grace. Questions? Comments? Jim?
Thanks, Grace, for that a fairly positive report. Just a couple of questions. Named person. It's my understanding that there's not going to be that great deal of difference to this authority in how we handle the sharing of information. But just to get some assurance from you that the sort of stalling of this at the moment isn't going to have any effect, and that we'll be carrying on as we normally would, and it's, you know, we're not changing systems, that we've not embedded anything in that we've had to kind of stop doing at the moment because the Scottish Government's no implementing that at the moment. Just to get some assurance on that. And on the dashboard issue, we're rolling it out to head teachers. It's just to get an assurance that we're retaining the ability to view that for centre, if you like, for monitoring perspective. Just to get some kind of assurance on that, because I think it's important, obviously, that we retain that ability here to, not us, but you, to be able to monitor how we're performing right down to kind of individual, almost, kind of levels.
Yeah, absolutely. Can assure you on the named person, Joan and myself and Mary, we've been in constant dialogue and together with health and so on, in order to make sure that things don't stall. So ensuring that all of our children are safe is an absolute priority for us. So that bit of the legislation is not going to stop the work that we've been doing. In terms of the dashboard, absolutely, we retain that because it's really important for me to know, is the data accurate within that, first and foremost? But the reason we're also sharing it with heads is we've realigned the school group managers. So I have 5 school group managers. They're now going to look after a learning community, and they're going to be in their schools, nurseries, far more. So they'll have that data. So their job for me is to go out and to say, I've noticed that these 2 children didn't attend on Thursday, Friday last week. Why was that? Or we've noticed that there's a trend within P4, some are underperforming. Can you talk me through that? So that we start to get really underneath the data. And we're going to run a session called Measuring with Meaning, where we're going to look at all of the different types of data we use in terms of forming our professional judgment. So it goes far deeper than the dashboard, but the dashboard's almost just signposting for them, but we absolutely are looking at that on a weekly basis, and I think that's made a difference to us reconnecting our resources to make a difference on the ground, and we can start to tell real learner journey stories of where we've made a real difference, and that to me in a small local authority we should be able to do. So it's an exciting development, but it does not replace the professional dialogue and the action on the ground, so it's not an add-on or a bolt-on.
Thanks, Grace. Argo.
Thank you, Chair. Just a question with regards to page 9, which is page 79. It's regarding the children in the early years. It's saying it's off target. By the end of 2015, the school year had 151 eligible two-year-olds, and your target was 200. What are we doing to try and reverse that?
So we have campaigns ongoing. That's really the snapshot of the date that we take the data. So it could be that some of the two-year-olds in the system have just turned three. You'll remember Mary talking about that, the date of the uplift. So we're continuing to roll out that in early years. So we're not even just satisfied with the target being 200. We want to raise that, but it's just at the date at which we pull that information out. So we are measuring that over time.
Russell.
Yeah, thanks. Can I just maybe stay on early years as well and you know, welcome how, you know, that we are providing for early years. But has there been a policy decision taken that it's all outsourced and that we're not trying to bring it in-house? Because you've increased it from 14 outsourced to 19 outsourced areas. And that's the first thing. And the second thing is, in the early years again, but maybe a wee bit up there in the statutory part of it between 3 and 5, the increase in the hours, have you looked at how we are going to be able to provide that? Is there the building and staff, because you spoke about staff in general here, but I mean just homing in on early years for a minute. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, have you started to do any work on the £100 million raid that's going to be taken out of council tax and put directly back into head teachers in future years, and what impact that will have? Because there's got to be a real impact assessment done on that, and I just wondered if that work had started up. I'm aware, Chair, that it's actually we're looking at the quarter that way, but at the same time, you've got to be looking forward as well, because that one's going to hit us square between the eyes and will actually make a difference in budgetary considerations come next year.
In terms of the early years, currently we have a whole range of partner providers and also council facilities. We've had two important meetings with both the Scottish Government and the Scottish Futures Trust. So we had people from property, John's directorate, all round the table last week. So we had a whole morning with the Scottish Government and Scottish Futures Trust. What we've done is we've outlined what we feel is going to be the cost of that. We've looked at all of our buildings. So we have an estate plan as well as the resource management plan, because there's also the training of these practitioners. Are they out there? Can we upskill others? And what the Scottish Government have done, they've got a work stream now looking directly at that. So can we join the dots, and is this deliverable by 2020? They're also looking at potential pilots so that they can start off with some areas that are actually delivering what they would see are the solutions to then share nationally. So they've been very interested in our Woodburn Hub idea, because what's important about that for us is we've got the vulnerable twos in before they transition to the nurseries, and it's actually on site within the school. So we're looking at early years not just being the 2, 3, 4, 5, but to the end of P1. So all of that is in the mix just now. We're currently waiting on information coming back from the Scottish Government around funding, because obviously every single local authority is going to have the pressure not just on buildings but on staffing and how we resource that. So we were really heartened that they've actually got a direct work stream, and what's good about that is they're offering potential pilots for people to opt into. So as Midlothian, we've said we would really like to be part of those pilots so we can work through some of the solutions. And one of the benefits, I suppose, in Midlothian is we've got the space. If you think about some of the local authorities, they can't expand. It's going to be super challenging for them. So we feel that we're in the right place to run a pilot itself. So I hope that answers that part. The head teachers, it's part of the Education Act. We're in a situation where there are two elements to the Education Act, and one talks about the strengthening of the middle. So when the OECD did their look at curriculum for excellence and the impact of that, they spoke about a concept of strengthening the middle. What we see is within the delivery plan for education is that where head teachers currently sit in the reporting structures into local authorities, that needs to be teased out far more. So we've got an ADES meeting coming up of directors to talk about what the strengthening in the middle means. In terms of the raising the funds through council tax, there's not yet been a firm announcement about where that money would actually go. So it says directly to schools at this point. And we're in conversations about that. For example, if you want to close the literacy gap by the end of P1, we know it's the same methodology that would be applied across the board. So there's an element about training teachers. So does it make sense to have some things directed to the local level, when actually you can deliver a whole programme? We've also talked about getting together in terms of the regionalisation groups. So Highland, they all merge all of their quality improvement teams to talk about how they're going to close that gap. So there's a number of different things in the mix just now, but certainly nothing confirmed within where those resources are actually directed. So that's a bit of a moving feast just now. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Okay, any other questions or comments while Grace is here? Okay, Grace, thank you very much. Now move on to, back to the agenda to follow, and we'll now move on to 4.1, which is the Council Performance Report. Kenneth Laurie, Chief Executive.
Thank you, Chair. The report set out under the five community planning themes, as it always is. We've got our refreshed priorities around about reducing inequalities in learning, which Grace has already touched on, inequalities in health, and inequalities in economic circumstances. I suppose that the big issue, or one of the big issues, is certainly the fact that we're trying to make these improvements at a time of unprecedented challenge, as a result, partly of, or in large part, because of the constrained funding, the demographic challenges we have, and the various cost pressures. But also it's a time where we're seeing a lot of imposed change to a degree. I mean, health and social care integration is part of that. I think we're making some very good progress on that, and no doubt Alison will talk in more detail about that. But also the issues that Grace was referring to in terms of the New Education Act and the National Improvement Framework, and how we respond to that, and how we ensure that we that these changes that are taking place don't, or we deal with them in a way that doesn't disrupt our own journey of improvement. And you've already heard that some very positive things happening in education at the moment. I think in terms of the quarterly report more broadly, there is much that's very positive, and no doubt your discussions with the heads of service this morning and this afternoon, you'll focus in on some of the particular aspects of that. I was going to highlight the sustained positive destinations. Grace has already touched on that. But I think in terms of, we shouldn't underestimate the importance of that in terms of improved life chances for individuals, particularly in our more deprived communities. I think it's also notable when we talk about, you know, the gap in economic circumstances we see across Midlothian. You know, within the last quarter, the council did approve the new pay and grading proposals, and that is all about boosting earnings at the bottom end of the pay scale. And we're working through the various challenges in terms of implementing that. We have the ongoing Delivering Excellence programme, whereby right across the organisation we're reviewing priorities, reviewing how we can do things differently, what services can be improved, which services we're going to have to look to make the savings in. And we're doing all of that against the background, as I say, of reduced government funding, increased service demands, and demographic cost pressures. So, as set out in the report that came to Council in June on the financial strategy, we're going through a series of discussions at the senior leadership group meeting, service by service, to work through the details and look at how we deal not just with the budget gap we have for 17-18, but also in terms of future years. And indeed, we had the first of these meetings earlier today. And I suppose these challenges are also compounded to a degree, and we've had this discussion at the recent council meeting and seminar, Midlothian is now recorded as being the fastest growing council area by population in Scotland, and all the pressures that produces in terms of development and the public infrastructure response to that. Just a few specifics that I draw attention to. I think one is the work that the council has done, Kevin and others leading on this, in terms of the Syrian vulnerable persons resettlement scheme. And I think that's been very positively done, and working with partners in the community to make sure that's a success. And something, again, that may come up this afternoon, is that some of the particular challenges around about waste management, the market conditions for recycling, and the potential cost pressures that arise from that. And that's a continuing area of concern. In terms of the PI summary, absence slightly higher than target. What you'll see as you go through the reports is that performance is very variable. Overall, as a council, we're actually performing well at the top quartile, but there's clearly some areas of service where we need to improve the sickness position. And secondly, in relation to the invoice processing, our performance has fallen away. And again, that relates to specific areas of service, and it's about some of the changes in systems we're introducing at the moment. But clearly, that's something where, having made a huge effort to improve performance successfully over a number of years, I'd be very unhappy if that dip in performance was not resolved and sorted out very quickly. Happy to take any questions, Chair.
Thanks, Kenneth. Just remind members, if you're wanting a lot of detailed answers, we'll probably get that for the HG service as we go through the day. Any questions at this stage for Kenneth? Russell?
Not so much a question, Chair, but I'll take this opportunity to urge the Chief Executive to do what he can about the Borders rail line. I mean, it's mentioned in here about how we want to get economic benefit out of that and how we continue about that. Not much use, for example, if it ain't running. And last night, for example, headline on Radio Scotland, again, both North Berwick, may I hasten to add, and the Borders line, not running because of signal problems. Now, if we've heard that once, we've heard that so many times now. And I think yesterday was the first year of opening. And I just feel, and Phil Vester was on, waxing lyrical about, we're doing this, we need to realise the challenges, and et cetera, et cetera. We can all do that. We can all be politicians when it comes to the bit of answering a question and not giving an answer. But the point of the matter is that while I can accept that they don't have enough capacity on it because it's a way back in the order chain and that's not coming through quickly enough, it doesn't go away from the fact that they're either cancelling trains or indeed trains aren't running. So if the Chief Executive gets an opportunity to meet with Abellio or Abellio in the near future, then I would urge him to raise on our behalf the frustrations, because it doesn't help with us selling this wonderful train system if it ain't running.
Thank you for that. I mean, I have had the opportunity, and I took it last week with the Head of Economic Development for Abellio ScotRail. And I think that given some of the concerns about public infrastructure more broadly and keeping pace with development, a well-functioning Borders Railway is absolutely critical for us. And I think, I mean, this council has always been really ambitious about what we can get out of Borders Rail. I'm intending to bring forward another report to the next council, which will build on that and look for the next series of opportunities in our communities along the rail line. There is an event tomorrow to mark the first anniversary, which will be hosted by Phil Verster. So I've made it my business to be there so that conversation can be had. So I think there's two distinct issues. One is about the ongoing performance and getting that sorted out. And the second one is about the issue of rolling stock. There is a major order being put in for rolling stock, because it's a challenge right across UK railways at the moment. But I think that in the context of the situation we face, We want some reassurance about the timing of that, the likely impact and volume of it, and when we'll begin to see that impact on Borders Railway. So these are issues I'm actively pursuing.
Ian.
Thank you, Chair. We're all well aware of the financial challenges which that this council has to address in the very near future. I mentioned yesterday, I think it's the order of about £10 million we've got to find next year. And I sit on Business Transformation Steering Group, and there's very little indication coming through that group as to how we're going to address that, apart from those gaps we already know that we have targets to fill. I have a concern that this is by far the biggest challenge we've had for many years. We also have an election coming up, local elections, and that's going to add significantly to the mix as to how people will react. I don't want to be in a position where we hear as councillors what the officials' proposals are a week, maybe if at best 2 weeks, before the decision is taken, and that amendments are then put forward by political groups on the day, on a piece of paper, handed out to everyone. It really is a shambles, the way that operates. I really do not want to see that happen again. I look to our colleagues in Edinburgh, where they propose a budget months in advance, they publicise it, they put it out to consultation, and they amend it according to the political will of the various groups within the council and the responses from the public. That, to me, is a sensible way to approach it. I would like an assurance from the council that we're going to move very rapidly towards that mechanism and that we're going to do something like that this year.
Thank you. I mean, I think that's a shared concern. I mean, the timetable in relation to the budget was set out in the June report, Council Financial Strategy Report. So I mentioned that this morning we had the first of nine sessions covering all service areas, where I'd, you'll recall, I tasked each directorate to come up with £5 million of proposals. £5 million wasn't a limit; it was a starting point. I think it's fair to say that the challenge varies across different service areas, and our room for manoeuvre, particularly when we're getting a lot of very specific guidance from the Scottish Government. We have this series of meetings. The last of these is on the 12th of October. So within a week of that, we would be seeking to finalise the officer proposals. So that's some 2 months before the December Council meeting, when we'd be looking to bring forward proposals. At the same time, we have had the Shaping Our Future consultation, which has been going on for some time. We will be reporting back to Council on that. We are going into a second phase of that, again, as was set out in the June report, which will enable us to garner some more detail from the public in terms of issues they might support or areas they'd be particularly concerned about. So we will bring all of that together, and certainly we'll be able to share the proposals emerging from the officer group by mid-October, 2 months in advance of officers bringing forward proposals to the council. In terms of Business Transformation Steering Group, again, as set out in the Financial Strategy Report, that is part of the process. There was a discussion about that at the most recent meeting of the group, which I know you were unable to attend. So that does play a role in the group, a role in the process. But more generally, as we've previously committed to do, we can share proposals with councillors more generally once we work through this internal process heading towards the middle of October.
Brian.
The Shaping Our Future consultation document, why was that not shared with all members?
The initial consultation document, I spoke to the leader and the leader of the opposition about. That was the introductory one. We're shaping up the second phase consultation document. Quite happy to share that when that's finalised, which I hope will be within the next 2 weeks or so.
Any other questions, Russell?
Could I maybe just come in as a supplementary to what Councillor Baxter was saying? Because Edinburgh has successfully gone out over the last few years and published a draft budget free for everybody to get involved. And the participation levels are actually very, very good indeed. Last year they went out in a two-year budget, which, although people may be in bewilderment about, the second year, which is the 2017-18 year, is actually mentioned a council tax increase way before the end of the last Scottish Government and the elections that came up in May. And the public bought into that. And it's cross-party, may I hasten to add. So, you know, without getting into the ifs and buts and ands. And that was done in that way. Now, I think what Councillor Baxter's saying is we might not all agree sometimes in the chamber and there's a lot of sabre-rattling and things go on like that. But I tell you right now, we whatever we do, and if we are going to have to put out our council tax next year, and we're going to be allowed to be 3% ceiling, etc., then we have to actually get that out early doors to the public. And that's where I do agree that you can't just wait around, particularly, dare I say, in an election year. It's absolutely nuts to do it, you know, and it could be, from what I'm hearing, is that the way the number crunching is going to go on, it could be the end of the year before we actually even get the definitive from the Finance Secretary. So, I mean, it really is getting pretty tight. Now, I just think we have to go ahead with what the indicators were and what was reported to Council, draw up what we can, bring it to Council, and then go out with that in draft form and wait for the surge back, whatever it happens to be. Sit down, look at that, and then come together, and we might not agree on lots of things, but at least we're going to have a debate around where we are, because at the moment, I do think the way that we do it is very, it's great in the historical, and I've done it, by the way, for 30-odd years, so, you know, it comes as a challenge to do it in any other way, and it's always been motions and amendments and etc., you know, on the day. But I do think that we've got to change our way, because if they are talking about community empowerment, if they are talking about community planning partnerships, and they're all going to be meaningful and not words, we have to do it differently. And I just say that, and I really do believe that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel, I think, very receptive to these comments, and, you know, it's quite instructive, I think, to see the very different way the different councils have worked on budgetary issues over the years. I mean, in terms of the specific issue of council tax, the question about whether people were prepared to see an increase in council tax was certainly part of the Citizens Panel survey this year, and we will bring results back. And my recollection is that it was 57-58% acceptance that actually raising council tax was the right thing to do. And, of course, we always get some very strong views by people that think exactly the opposite. In relation to this year's budget, whilst we don't have absolute clarity on this, my understanding is that the Scottish Government is very much holding fire post Brexit to see what comes up in the autumn statement. They've already been quite clear that it will only be a one-year settlement, and I think probably the original proposal would have been for a three-year settlement. We might see a three-year settlement next year. I think we'll only see a one-year settlement this year. I think it will probably be well into December before we get a clear picture of that. And last year, of course, there was a lot of working through of the detail, particularly in relation to the £250 million social care fund. And I think that the time that took and the detail in relation to that put us slightly on the back foot in terms of our budgetary work, and we're endeavouring to catch up on that to a degree. So I think it is very challenging, but I think also that if we can move to a situation where we do have that kind of more open discussion about the the challenges and the issues, which I think we have very successfully at an officer level, perhaps is more difficult to replicate at a political level, something would be a good thing to aim for.
Any other questions or comments? Yeah. I tend to agree with both Ian and Russell on how we're doing the budgets. Now, when you go back, Russell, to where we were 10 years ago, what you had was you had the corporate management team's budget put forward about 3 to 4 months before we were going to be asked in the December to adopt it. And at that stage, you had 7 directors with maybe 14, 15 heads of department, had put forward all their ideas. Each of them met with each of the groups. It didn't just give the politicians a chance to look through the budget. It gave you a chance to speak to other directors and other heads of service as to what they thought about proposals from other people. You take Donald Mackay, for example. Every time he put forward a budget, saving it was let's shut 3 schools, because he knew fine well on a political level that wouldn't be accepted. So what he would hope was that his budget would remain unchanged for that year. So therefore you were relying on the politicians who had been here quite a long time to be able to give you guidance and where to look, but you were also relying on different heads of service and directors saying, well, why is that director not taking that, and why is that head of service not doing that? They could save money with that. So as a politician, you were getting feedback for the professionals properly. Under this system, as we stand at the moment, it's absolutely impossible because you're not getting the budgets. Now, Ian's been quite vocal on the fact that you get this stuff tabled on the day. There are quite often, by the time we're actually getting the stuff, you're getting to sit down with officers to discuss what other options are available. You've virtually no got time to table stuff. So I've got to be honest, I can't see it changing much this year, because in the discussions we've had with the Chief Executive, it's going to be late on on this year before he's going to be ready to put something forward to us. So I didn't know how we are going to have any great meaningful debate beforehand. Kenneth?
Just briefly, I suppose two things I'd say. Two things that are very different from what the situation was 10 years ago in local government. One is the scale of the challenge. Now, of course, that's a reason for ensuring that members do have plenty of time. And secondly, certainly in this council, it's about the way we do it now is it is a collective effort. Because if a particular part of the council, you mentioned historic examples, come up with something that isn't going to be acceptable, I'm going to send them back. I'm not having that. It has to be a collective effort. We're doing it as a team or a small council. We should be perfectly capable of coming together and discussing these issues. It is quite an intensive process. We do have a timetable for it that was approved by the council in June, and you will have the proposals 2 months before the council meeting with the decisions need to be made. So it might not be perfect. I accept that. We need to improve it, but you will have that timescale to consider the significant proposals that are coming forward.
Okay. I've got to be honest with you, that just makes it sound even worse for me, because it sounds awfully like here what we've got is we've got a collective corporate management team which is effectively wiping out any political input and so by the time you're getting it, it's done and dusted. Sorry, Kenneth, but we will agree to disagree on this.
Well, I'm sorry, Convener, I disagree with you as well. I don't think that we accept what the corporate management team bring forward to us at all. And again, there's a misstatement here, calling it the autumn statement for the UK. It's more like the middle of winter statement. That's not our fault. That's Westminster's fault all over again.
I would imagine, Joe, anything you have to say is Westminster's fault. Any other reasonable comments? Any other constructive or comments worth putting in? No. OK, thanks for that. Thank you, Kenneth. We'll now move on to item 4.2, Adult Health and Social Care and Performance. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Start off by, we've referred to the development in health and social care integration within quarter one. One of the primary changes within that was in terms of some of the management arrangements. There's been changes for both Alistair Shorts and my own post within that. Alistair is now the head of service with responsibility for primary care and older people, and that's across both health and social care services. And I have responsibility for adult services, which is primarily under 65s, but there are some areas such as learning disabilities, mental health, where that does overlap in terms of an age profile. Moving forward, we are looking at how we can develop our service plans to ensure that we've got more of a split in amongst that, and ensuring that Alistair will be available to answer questions at those meetings. But for today's meeting, certainly I'll continue to do both older and adult services. And I suppose that will also reference, while there'll be more reference to health services within the document as well, as heads of service, we are managing across both of those areas. And as services begin to integrate more fully, the overlap and interconnectedness between health and social care will become more apparent. So I think there'll be a change in some of the reports as we begin to move forward within that. Carers, critical to keeping people safe within our community, and it's a really critical for us to provide the right level of support. So the Carers Scotland Act, the publication of the Carers Scotland Act 2016, has allowed us to look at revising our own carers strategy locally and aided us to set our priorities for the coming years. We're expecting further guidance from the Scottish Government, and a commencement date has been identified of April into next year. One of the key areas that we have been doing, one of the things that has come up through our local carers strategy is that carers feel that they've been really struggling to prioritise their own health and wellbeing within their caring role. So we have ensured that our community health inequality team have been offering sessions from the vocal centre to ensure that carers have access to a broad range of health. So maybe that's about smoking cessation, helping with physical health, getting blood pressure tests, and it's a broad kind of about an hour's session that carers can get to prioritise their own health within that. Older people services, there's a wide range of different activities that are going on there at the moment. We've been reviewing our daycare provision. That's meant a couple of key changes within that. So we are now using the Highbank Daycare Centre is now moved to be provided out of Middle Lothian Community Hospital. It's given us a much better resource and is ensuring that it's within a service that's not part of a residential unit, and also ensures that we've got the right things like toilet facilities, level access for those people who have a higher level of support needs but are still living within their own community. And we've been doing work to develop MARC building into a community hub, and been working very closely alongside Woodburn Daycare. That seems to be taking slightly longer than we had expected, and there are some challenges within that, but we are hopeful that that will continue along. Work's going underway at this point in time about how we will reprovide Highbank residential care. It's an intermediate care facility, has some really fantastic results in terms of what we're doing, but as a building is probably not as fit for purpose as we would like it to be. We're very conscious of the increasing demands that we're facing. We've been doing some analysis work in terms of who's receiving services, where the demands are, and have we got the right bed configuration to ensure, particularly as we're looking at the move to the three-day delayed discharge target, how do we make better use of our intermediate care facilities to enable us to achieve those goals, both in terms of stopping people going into hospital in the first place and how we help to pull them out much quicker. So there's work that's going on that to be what a new building would look like as part of that process. Transformation of new buyers continues. Specialist dementia units will be in two of the streets there, and we're anticipating that our new staffing structure will be in place for October of that point in time. Learning disabilities, again, a fairly major programme of transformation work is undertaken there. Building work is underway on the complex care housing development in Pennycook. That's a 12-person individual core and cluster model of accommodation. We have had a couple of requests to visit that, so if other councillors would like to take the opportunity to go and visit the site to get a better sense of what that development will look like and get a clearer understanding of that, certainly if you get in touch with me, I can look to organise that for people. The tender for the care is out. We're expecting that back fairly shortly, and the building should be completion in February 2017, so we'll be looking to begin to move the first residents and tenants in at that point in time. We've also been undertaking a fairly significant piece of work to recommission some of our residential and respite service provision. And as part of that, it's ensuring that we're making arrangements for those three remaining people with a learning disabilities who are still in long-stay hospital who are ready for discharge. Within mental health, one of the biggest challenges for us has actually been from a health perspective in terms of access to psychological therapies, and we've seen really significant waiting times within psychological therapies. We've been doing a lot of work locally to see if there are alternatives to the psychological therapies, if there's a way of supporting people in a preventative manner, to better support them within the community, so, and whether we can get better access points for them. So we have developed a range of different activities that include social prescribing alternatives to ensure that we can support people in the most appropriate way whilst they're waiting for that intensive psychological therapy support. Substance misuse service, I think this has been raised here before, but just to clarify that we got final announcement from the Scottish Government in July 2016 of a 23% reduction in the funding that is available for drug and alcohol services. That is a fairly significant cut to the services, and that covers services that are provided by the local authority, by NHS Lothian, and by the voluntary sector. Across all of the services, that's going to have a fairly significant impact. There is a local core delivery group which is looking at how we can mitigate against those and what areas we can need to look at. I would say that the letter that we had received from the Scottish Government did ask us to ensure that we saw no reduction in service and that we didn't see any reduction in the outcomes, but a 23% budget cut makes that extremely difficult to achieve on a local basis. The chair of MELDAP is writing to the Scottish Government to make our views known. A paper had gone to the Integrated Joint Board, and there was a strong view from the members of the Integrated Joint Board that we needed to express our concern about the level of reduction in funding and how that's going. We're in the fortunate position locally is that we had some underspend position from last year, so we've been able to maintain some services whilst we do that reconfiguration in this year, but that's only a short-term fix, and we are needing to look at how we can do that. On a more positive note, there's been some really good work going on between substance misuse and mental health about those individuals with dual diagnosis, and we're doing an awful lot of work to see how we can make use and develop a recovery hub that's joint between staff in health and social care across mental health and substance misuse. And there's work with our facilities team to look at building accommodation within the Dalkeith area to develop that service. And there's strong engagement in that. So there's lots of positive work that's still happening in that area. Within criminal justice, there's the new Community Safety and Justice Partnership that's providing us with the transition arrangements for the new structure for community justice, and there's some good partnership and involvement from around this table at that group. The other service area that we just want to identify is the Spring Service that I know a number of you are aware of, which is the women's service to help support people women who may be at risk of offending, may have other issues such as mental health and substance misuse issues. We've been able to secure some extra funding to recruit a social worker for the Spring Project, and that's to enable us to offer a level of support to women who are about to come into Spring, and also to offer some support once the Spring programme itself is finished to ensure that those women get well and embedded into the supports that are available in their local community, and that we're doing transitioning both in and out of what is the Spring short-term programme that we're offering. We continue to have a range of funding pressures in terms of running a needs-led service, and we continue to work as hard as we can to look at what those shortfalls is within that. Capacity and quality of services, we've been experiencing some particular issues within care at home for older people's services in the west of Midlothian. We are in the process of changing our provider within the west of Midlothian. We did not feel that the provider that we had there was working effectively with us to make the changes that we required to have a good quality service for the individuals. So we are in that process of transition at this point in time, but it is causing a level of capacity issues for us in care at home, which is having a knock-on impact on our ability to deliver in terms of our delayed discharge targets, as it's creating a backlog in other parts of our service at this point in time. Happy to take questions.
Thanks, Alison. Questions, comments? Russell.
Thanks, Chair. Just a general question about adult care services. And going back in time, you know, and I know it's historical data, but when Lothian Region was about, and when the local government reorganisation came around and we ended up with unity authorities, there was a disproportionate amount of cash went in from what was there before in the pot into Midlothian. That argument was taken up with the then UK government and then indeed Scottish government thereafter. Now, I know that's historical, but what alarmed me just now is a letter comes from on high to tell you to do X, Y, and Z, And by the way, you know, and the subtext is 23% reduction. Now, we're the best one in the world. We have an increased need in adult social care. As we learn as human beings how to take care of humans in different ways, in different manners, we actually, you need to have the resource to do that. Now, I just don't know at what point it breaks. I know what you're doing, eh? Plug a hole because there was a wee underspend there, so I'll move that money about and that's fine. Plugged. Whew, thank goodness, I'll get through this year. Oh, something else is coming over the horizon. Now, I worry, and I genuinely worry that we are, you know, we're not getting the right response, maybe from the civil servants. Maybe the civil servants aren't going up to the minister to say exactly what the state of the play is. Not maybe just in Midlothian, there'll be other areas right throughout Scotland to actually start to say, listen, we're going to have to look at this a whole way different. Now, I know we've done a heck of a lot. The Integrated Joint Board, well, we'll wait and see what that's like, because I think the jury's out on that one, to be perfectly honest. And I know that from colleagues up and down the country that there's a big question mark over there. We're working, you know, we actually, as a council, we're one of the first, actually, to go ahead and integrate adult services along with health. And we pulled that together, and it's working, you know, with the director over the two aspects of that. But nevertheless, it comes down, does it not, to have we got the ability on the ground, with the ground troops, so to speak, to actually do a job of caring for those people that need care in the community. And I'm just a little bit worried that it's getting guy near to breaking point. And I just wondered, has there been a thought about a summit? Because no doubt other authorities will be feeling this whole thing as well. We can't. There's no use having government policy saying you're going to do this if you don't actually work out how you're going to actually achieve that. And I remember many, many years ago, Robin Cook stood in the House of Commons and said, I agree fundamentally with what you're trying to do about care in the community. Excuse me a minute, though. Where's the money? Is it following the money trail? And, of course, the answer was it wasn't. And we had to work hard to get to overcome that. So, really, you know, it's a direct question is, can we do anything about it? And you know, are you coming as officers to politicians and saying to them, excuse me a minute, do you realise how bad this is? Can you lobby? And I looked to the provost there. Can you lobby to get your ministers to actually see that we're really struggling to meet your targets? You're asking for that to be achieved. We'll achieve it, but we need resource too in order to achieve that. No matter what we've got, we've not got all the tools in the toolbox.
I'm glad you started with the easy questions. I mean, I think the challenges that we're facing, I think, are being addressed on a number of different fronts. I think you're right. I think there is a real challenge for us in terms of increasing demand, both in terms of the numbers of people that we're needing to look at supporting, both in terms of an ageing population and in terms of those number of young people with very complex needs who are actually reaching adult services. I think we've got that dual issue in terms of finite numbers, but I think we also have a challenge in terms of expectation of people within the community in terms of what's a good quality of life and how we support them with that. It can be very difficult professionally to be having those conversations around, I know that by giving an extra bit of support it would take you to a different level, but we have eligibility criteria and we're meeting within that. And I think that's a really difficult issue for frontline staff when they're working alongside someone and trying to advocate for them and working with them in a really person-centred way, working with those challenges of budget constraints around some of that. I think there's a number of different areas where we're addressing that. So certainly as Chief Social Work Officer, a member within Social Work Scotland and the executive group there, and how we're having that dialogue with the government around what some of those challenges are and what the pressures are for us, ensuring that the MELDAP chairs and MELDAP chair and across all of the ADPs are getting in touch around those particular areas. I'm involved in a group with COSLA to look at what the funding arrangements are that are coming out with the new carers guidance, because it looks at this point in time that what we're being asked to do and the funding portfolio don't quite match up in terms of where we're going, so there's a danger for new legislation without the right funding formula that's behind it. So we are on a number of levels doing that, but actually at certain points in time we're faced with the fact that we have people in need in our community and we're doing the best that we can. I think within adult social care, I mean, social work generally, it's not just adult social care that face these pressures, and I'm sure Joan will be able to talk the same with children's services. I think it's a real challenge and dilemma for us within some of this in terms of how we meet that conflicting demand. I think we've got good track record of looking at how we're delivering things and seeing if there's different ways of us supporting people, if there's different ways of us streamlining some of that pathway to do that. But you're right, there will come a breaking point for us in terms of how we manage to do that. There's a danger that we end up focusing on some of those areas, so we cut some of the preventative areas of work, because actually at the point that I'm needing to make sure that I'm feeding someone, I'm able to take them to the toilet, have them washed, put them to bed, those are going to be the critical things that I'm not going to be able to stop doing, and I'm not going to be able to cut at any point in time. So there is a danger and a risk within some of this that we stop some of the preventative work, which actually will end up with more crisis work at some point in the future. And we face funding pressures from a range of different areas. I think health and social care integration, I know you say the jury's out, I think actually in a Midlothian perspective we're in a fairly fortunate position. There's some really good working relationships locally, which I think make it an easier position than I know myself from speaking to colleagues in other local authority areas. I think we are in a very fortunate position here. I think there are some opportunities within that to look at doing further reshaping and what that might look like. And I suppose it depends what further pressures and cuts come down as to how achievable those will be for us.
Have you ever thought about a community cooperative? You know, taking the lesser, and I don't, this is going to come out wrong, but taking the lesser activities. I mean, Alison, you mentioned, for example, going in and seeing people are okay, maybe, you know, making sure they've got a breakfast or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. About actually, you know, we talk about community involvement, and we, you know, there's papers that we'd actually are holding up a desk leg that I've cut off, you know, these days, because there's so much comes out on that, but we, which is great in word form, but looking to, you know, to do something, say, a small community, see if they would engage to actually do the lesser tasks while still having the professionals, you know, doing what they have to do anyway, but taking that down. And so it's actually going in and giving back. It's the giving back to the community. And there's a lot of people out there that would actually probably do something. You know, a lot of professional people that have actually had a good life out of working would actually be quite happy to get back in and get involved. And a kind of like a community cooperative. And I just wonder if it's worthwhile looking at that kind of modelling. It's not going to take it all away. The pressures aren't all going to go away. Could you still? It doesn't just happen, you know, by snapping your hands. But I'm just wondering if something like that might be an opportunity to look at us doing it in a different way. Because, you know, we're all part of a society. We're all, part of a community. But, you know, we don't tend to get involved in that level because it's always somebody else. And I just wonder if that might be an opportunity to do a little trial on that. That's all.
It actually fits quite well with a pilot we are looking to run. So I mentioned that we were looking at changing our provider in the west of Midlothian. As part of that, I'd been doing an exercise for us to look at what works well and what doesn't work so well. And I think we've gone down a route, if we look at older people's care at home, we've got ourselves quite down a route where we've become very task-focused and we've become very time-focused. So Mrs. Smith gets 4 visits a day, and it's at 9, it's 12, it's 4 and it's 7, and she gets this amount of time at each of those visits, and these are the things that get done in each of those visits. So we've then got carers who are running around trying to hit the time slots that they've got, and they get stuck in behind an accident somewhere, so they don't quite get there, and it has that knock-on impact. We spare a lot of travel time for people in amongst that. We've got fairly episodic episodes of care, so a GP might be in at these key points and a district nurse is in at different points and the carers are in every day. When we get involved in an assessment, a family member comes to us and says, I'm struggling, so we automatically go to a seven-day-a-week service. We don't have conversations with family about what can you still do, what do you need support with. So actually, we might only need to provide support 3 days a week because the family can still between themselves do other bits. And I think we've kind of gone so far down a journey that we're needing to take a bit of a step back. So the new provider, although we've asked them in the short term to come in and do an as-is and take over what's there, we've done that on the understanding that we can look at this point in time in a public social partnership to run pilots that are community-based. So we can look at how we can engage the wider community and how we can engage all of the professionals that work in that community together so that actually we have much more of a community-based service so that we can have a bit more flex in the care. So today I might only need 10 minutes, but tomorrow I might need an hour. And the team has the ability to do that. It doesn't have to keep coming in as a referral. So there's work that's going on around how do we redesign that? How do we involve the wider communities? And one of the exercises we did as a group was to look at what are the assets in a community? And we picked a community at random, and we'd chosen Pennycook because that was where we were having the problem with the care at home provider. And we started listing what is there for older people within Pennycook. And it took a number of flip chart sheets because actually there's a lot. And actually very little of it is provided by health and social care. There's some core bits we do. But actually there's lots of other community things. And how do we ensure that we get all of those working together? The only thing I would say about community involvement is when it's getting to being intimate personal care and things like that, a lot of that preventative work that can go alongside making people feel safe and connected into their community, you're right, we've not been as good as we could be in some ways of engaging that in a better way. So hopefully, as the pilot work moves on, once we get over the crisis of transfer from one provider to the other, we should be able to see some of that coming up in the west of Midlothian, certainly as we begin to do community work in a different kind of way around older people. So hopefully we should be able to report back on that at some point shortly.
Yeah, just the kind of comments if you want, but when we look at private home care and we look at council home care, you know, there's nothing in the middle. You know, and we've had that kind of discussions before. There should be something, you know, that's in between, you know, arm's length wise or a cooperative model or fully support. And we've had these kind of discussions in the past and various other areas. On the budget and the reactionary, the whole service is a demand-led service. You know, so it's so hard to have a strategic plan for it. But when you do have a proposed plan and the carpet's pulled under your feet, but a decision by a higher level, the last decision that was raised at the integrated board, and I made the points that, you know, surely these people should be under proper time plans for making these decisions. They should be under proper assessments for making these decisions, the quality impact assessments, we all call it within the council, but the health service used to call them rapid impact assessments. You know, and surely that decision-making process should be part of those assessments as well, before they're actually dictated to our integrated joint board, which I think is working quite well. You know, and is bringing many things together.
Margot.
Thanks, Chair. I'd just kind of like to applaud the work that's done by the Midlothian and East Lothian Drugs and Alcohol Partnership. They do a great amount of work out there. I know the Horizon Cafe in our own area here in Dalkeith, and I've been at various occasions where people that have come through recovery are obviously speaking about their journey, as it seems to be the buzzword nowadays. And it's quite worrying to see that the money is going to be cut for such an important service. The whole mental health issue and that, as well as the physical health of these people. And I understand that they're obviously finding some money for this year, but it is pretty worrying that the coming years may have a really detrimental effect on them. With regards to the older people strategy you've had in here, obviously I know a bit about the Mark building, and the Silk Purse and Sow's Ears come to mind. It's a very old building. It's not had much maintenance done over time. And the project is taking time because it always comes down to finance. the daycare have some finance, but we're trying to draw some some money for the council. So I'd make a plea if directors and officers can kind of speak to each other and see if you can put a bit of money into the MART building. I do have concerns about the word community hub. If that goes out to the community, they'll say, is that all we're getting, is the MART building, given that this council has been supportive of the Dalkeith Miners plan for a community hub. But there are things that are happening, and I know the High Bank will take time, but I think that that type of service will be really good to the community as well, given that we have such an elderly population. Thank you.
With regards to the recovery area, we obviously, as part of this process, when we're looking at how we can make those savings, have done a range of consultation exercises with users and carers, and it was really clear from that that recovery is one of the areas that they do want us to continue to focus on. What I would say is that most of the people that were at the consultation event were those people in recovery, so that might have in some way influenced the areas that they wanted us to input, and that those people who were in the high-end treatment, assessment and treatment areas weren't the ones that were taking part in consultation. So we are doing what we can. Within Midlothian, we've had a really strong focus on recovery for some period of time, and we don't want to lose that as part of this. So it is about how we can keep that recovery focus throughout all of the work we do and not lose some of that, because it's about sustaining people in that recovery process as well, rather than seeing people slipping back into the system. So it is an area that we are still continuing to prioritise within that. And I'll take the note about the community hub. It wasn't certainly suggesting that it was the only area. We are doing work alongside colleagues within the council to see what money we can pull together to make that a reality, certainly.
Joe. Once again, can we have to say that all the cuts that come down the line are imposed by the Scottish Government, who gets pocket money for Westminster, and it's Westminster that continues. I'm sorry, but the Smith Commission suggested that all benefits and tax be passed on to the Scottish Government, but I'm afraid Westminster decided, no, we can't give them these money-raising powers, because they might be good at it. Anyway, we should also, besides us approaching the Scottish Government and asking them to mitigate once again for Westminster cuts, maybe we should be, especially the MELDAP thing, because we are, we have the army in Midlothian, and I find that the MOD imposing on us time and time and time again, maybe we should be approaching the MOD and saying, seeing you send us these people with these problems, send some money to go with it. We're expected to give people houses, jobs, and things like that. If they're called a veteran is somebody that can sign up for one day to the TAs. And I believe that in Scotland we have something like 200,000 people that can be called a veteran. It's maybe time for us to approach the UK Government and the MOD and say, please send us some money to help us deal with the problems that you created by sending these people to illegal wars.
I'm not actually sure what you've just asked there, John. I'm not actually sure what the MOD or the Army has to do with this, or am I missing something?
I think you might be missing something, Convener, because the MOD send us people with mental health problems, they come out of the army with drugs and drink problems, and they get passed on to us. The MOD take no care of them whatsoever. Maybe about 6 months, and then they get passed on to the NHS. And Midlothian are expected to give these people houses and jobs.
I'm actually glad this has been recorded. Thank you, Councillor Batchelor, because I'm sure the public out there will love to hear that kind of statement. Alison, one of the things that have and was said at the IJB was the fact that we were looking at a 23% cut from the Scottish Government, not from Westminster, from the Scottish Government. However, the decision and the debate there, which was more positive, was about the fact that, number one, we shouldn't accept it, we should write back pointing out the problems that this could cause, and actually pointing out that a lot of the pressures on hospitals and attendances at hospitals and use out of our services was people with drug problems, drink problems, etc.
And indeed, I gave an example of one person I had met at the recovery hub who unfortunately had actually strayed off the recovery path, and the effect that that had on that person and the effect that it had on the police and the ambulance services later on in that day. Now, at that, and I know we're a different hat on here, and it's just to see what your thoughts are and what the council's thoughts were. There was also discussion on that, what if the Scottish Government won't or can't reinstate that money? Is there something that the IGB, should the Health Board just be saying, well, wait a minute, it's a 23% cut, we're going to have to cut it? Or is there something else that's now a lesser priority that we should be looking to divert money for other areas that the Health Board are dealing with to fill that gap? Because when we visited, I think they called it the Recovery Cafe, the message that came across loud and clear to us was the fact not only that it was appreciated, but the fact was that there was a dire need, and especially for people who had alcohol-related problems. Now, with the advent of social media, even if you were a recovering alcoholic, you're in the house, you can see your pals at parties, they're out dining with glasses of wine, and there was nothing. And people who were trying to recover from alcohol felt that there was sort of nothing at all there to support them when it came to Friday night at 5 o'clock when the cafe shut, and they were spending the whole weekend, they felt, without recovery. So if anything at all, I think there was a clear desire for the people that were in recovery to say, well, and this was people who'd been long-term in recovery. One chap, I think, has been over 10 years in recovery and never strayed off, but clearly saying that when, you know, we need to increase that service. So there was a look for a demand for perhaps more money. But the reality there is that through adult social care, through the council, through the health board, we need to try to ensure that what we're spending in one area cuts the spend in another area. And by providing that service, if you can stop that one person falling off the recovery session, the money that then knocks on is better used and you're not spending somewhere else. So I'm just wondering, is there anything the council, is there... What are your thoughts on where that service is now? Are you thinking along the lines of, well, yeah, we need to rebalance other services, or is this one of the ones that can be least priority? Because you can actually ask that you get the same outcomes all you want, but if you're cutting a service by 23% of its finances, you absolutely can't do that. So it's just to see whether you think that we could shift money about for other areas and make that as a more priority than some other stuff that we're doing.
I suppose in two parts. So I suppose we are taking a proactive approach to go back to the Scottish Government, both from IJB and from Chair of MELDAP, to be really clear about what we think the impact of the cuts will be, and we are addressing that. They may still come back saying it's a 23% cut, which means that we can't hold off on doing some of that planning locally. In terms of where we are with some of that, I think we've identified some savings already, but there's further savings to identify. There is a small core group that's looking at that, and I would suggest that I could come back with something potentially at the next meeting in a bit more detail, because I think we haven't fully been able to get to the bottom of that bit of information. There's been some lack of clarity in terms of where some of the funding is, and we've been pulling the full amount of funding that's available, not just the money that does come from the Scottish Government. There is core funding within local authority and core funding within NHS as well. So we've been trying to get that full picture of all the spend on drug and alcohol services, where those interplays are in terms of some of the other areas, such as mental health being one of those key areas in terms of how we can develop that. So I think you're right in terms of we might need to look at how we shift some of that money around and what that proposal would be, but would suggest would come back once the local core group has done more of the analysis work on those facts and figures and is able to present at that point in time.
Thanks, Alison. Any other questions or comments? Alison, thank you. Now move on to 4.3, Customer and Housing Services. Kevin.
Thanks, Chair. In terms of quarter one, in housing. We reviewed the housing allocation policy. That was reported to Council in May, taking account of public and member consultation and also the legislative changes. And we're presently in the process of making those policy changes to the policy being implemented. Customer services, we in the first quarter had managed to extend our free public Wi-Fi provision across all libraries, but also into our new mobile library, and that's a shared service with East Lothian from our new vehicle being deployed. There was also the launch of Transforming Care After Treatment, that's the Macmillan Living Well project, which is based now at the Lasswade Library for cancer survivors, and we're presently looking to extend that into Pennycook area as well, so that we have coverage across the county. We were also successful in the first quarter of obtaining external funding through Connect Online, and that's allowed us to establish coding clubs for primary age children in our libraries, and also at this early stage that's been well received. In community safety, we had the delivery of the over-provisioning statement, again through public consultation and also with members, which had been based on a profile exercise of the impact of alcohol-related harm in our communities, and that was put forward and agreed by the licensing board subsequently. We also established in the first quarter the Council's Integrity Group, which takes on the partnership role for deterring and disrupting criminality in our communities and also the potential across our services and with partners. In customer services, there's also a transformation commitment in terms of a target saving through delivering excellence, and that has been achieved already through the operational savings that have been identified. We're presently looking at service structure changes and formal consultation with unions and staff in terms of delivery of that phase. Challenges from first quarter in relation to homelessness continues. Albeit we've carried out over the years a number of preventative measures, there's still presentations on an annual basis of around 500 households who present to us. We've reported previously to Council in terms of the reuse of Pentland House and the previous Midfield, now Poulton Centre, and work is currently going on in both those buildings in terms of conversion to allow us to provide better and improved temporary accommodation for homeless households who present to us. We're also in the midst of re-tendering for our bed and breakfast provision, because that will be significantly reduced as a result of the reuse of those buildings. As has been mentioned, we've had further arrivals through the Syrian Vulnerable Persons Scheme. We're now halfway through in terms of the commitment that the Council gave to resettle 40 people over the period of a five-year scheme. So we're 1 year into that, and as I say, having met that half that commitment already. In terms of revenues, there's further developments in terms of universal credit. We have been notified that we will be fully migrating to universal credit from April 2017 in Midlothian, so there's current efforts going on in terms of the work preparation for that to extend it to all households. There's also, as we've reported previously to Council, a further phase of the benefit cap being introduced this coming autumn. We anticipate from initial scanning that that will affect 131 claimants. We've still yet to get further detail from DWP, but we'll continue to work in terms of mitigating the impact that there is likely to be to those households. In community safety, we have seen a rise in the last quarter of antisocial behaviour complaints. Certainly, those have been youth-orientated, particularly in the localities of Woodburn and Bonnyrigg. As a consequence, the Community Safety Delivery Group, through partners of police and criminal justice, and certainly through our colleagues and children and families through the youth opportunities for street work, have been addressing those, and we've seen in the current quarter significant improvement in terms of those behaviours being changed and a reduction in the reports of antisocial behaviour. In terms of the service priorities, we have 12 assigned to customer and housing services, and as is detailed, these are either completed or on target in the quarter one period, and I haven't been in a position to say that here before. However, in terms of the summaries, our performance and complaints has simply not been good enough in the first quarter, and it's particularly disappointing with the progress that we've been making in improving that. In analysis of the reasoning behind that, certainly there's consistency issues across the services, and that's been addressed. I can make members aware that that has been rectified in terms of maintaining targets, achieving targets at present in quarter two. I'm happy to take questions, Chair.
Thanks, Kevin. Questions or comments? Russell?
Thanks, Chair. Just on the part regarding the homeless and the bed and breakfast situation, Kevin, I know you've alluded to, for example, the two areas where you're converting at the moment, but nevertheless, that will only touch the tip of the iceberg, dare I say. Now, we used to have, and I don't know if it exists now, so Chief Executive will probably put me in my place if I've got this wrong, but we used to have what was called, or used to be allowed, to do spend-to-save schemes. And we did a few over the years. I mean, whether they were ever monitored to see if they were spend-for-save is neither here nor there. I wanted to, though, home in on the amount of homeless people that, on average, we have to actually try and find accommodation for. It's not always as easy to find them, for example, in Midlothian, so we have to go further afield. Now, we all know, for example, that, I mean, with Edinburgh and the way that its tourism is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 a year, then the prices there are quite prohibitive in the sense of putting our vulnerable people there. And I just wondered if there was any thoughts or any sense of looking at some type of accommodation, dare I say, and I kind of, I mean, they've been doing student accommodation now for quite a while. We went to see these bedsit places in Westfield in Edinburgh a number of years ago, and it really looked as if it was a model that could work. And I just wondered if there was any thoughts about a spend to save scheme in order that we can actually affect the amount of money that we put out there to bed and breakfast accommodation. Thanks.
Short answer is yes. Certainly we came forward to council relative to the housing allocation policy, and there was a provision in that to allow us to go and purchase 10 properties, and we're in the process of doing that. We've purchased 6 to date. There will also be a paper coming to council in terms of the prospect of purchasing further properties as a consequence of the potential of the Dalkeith Town Centre regeneration, and clearly the impact that will have on owner occupiers, there are 20 there, and the potential that we could make use of those in the short term. There's also discussions ongoing with Scottish Government in terms of resourcing, because housing is a priority for them, and certainly there is funding becoming available for a whole range of different schemes to add to the stock. Primarily, they want new builds because, understandably, they want to add to the existing stock rather than acquiring different tenure types into the public sector. But through those range of discussions, as I say, the short answer is yes. As opposed to using our own direct resources, we're looking to those opportunities in the meantime. But it's also been referenced before, and I know it will be again, in terms of the amount of reserve that we hold in the HRA, and clearly in terms of our new bill provision. And again, there's a report coming to September Council in regard to that. But we continue to look at all the opportunities that are available to us, and that will remain one that's currently in discussion, but through different avenues at the present time.
Marshall?
I appreciate your answer, Kevin, with regard to purchasing 10 individual properties, but I was more thinking along the lines of why aren't we looking at a new build in terms of, as I said, like student accommodation, but that kind of property, you know, and by the way, there was a site next door, but anyway, that's another story. But, I mean, it just seems to me that there's a real opportunity in town centre when you get a site to actually do something like that, and that would have actually meant that we're starting to eat into that £1 million a year bill that you're reporting to, and I think it's going to take a heck of a long time purchasing a one house here and a one house there to be perfectly, you know, objective about this. I mean, it's going to take forever to get that £1 million down, or the 83, average 83, you know, let's not say it's always going to be, hopefully never always going to be like that, but the unintentionally homeless has been there with us for a long time, and I just think that, you know, there might be a real opportunity to do a new build, but do it in that kind of the student flats, but I mean, call it homeless accommodation or whatever, and I think in town centres it might have been ideal to do it that way.
Certainly your premise is right, but the cost of that as a new build, as well as the neighbour reaction to the potential of a development on in their locality, is something that we need to address in the bigger picture. Certainly we found in terms of the reuse of Pentland House, and to a lesser degree in terms of what was Midfield, that we've renamed to Poulton Centre, and indeed some of those individual purchases that are going on as well. There is individual locality reaction to some of those, understandably. So it's part of an education process in terms of people becoming homeless by chance rather than choice. And you know, I could go on and on about that throughout the day, and we'll not get converts, but it's about reassuring people that we manage these particularly well, because we do, and certainly we're trying to ensure that people have better outcomes for them and those households. And a lot of that's been talked about by Grace, and indeed by Alison as well, because we play our part to that. There's the whole read across the range of services, which is evident to yourselves. So yes, there's a potential, but that's a significant commitment. It costs about £6 million to do something like that, to take that out of the reserve, as opposed to providing new build mainstream housing, or indeed complex care or learning elsewhere in the community too. So it's the choice as opposed to the principle, which more readily acceptable to communities. They will see derive the benefit from the next generation going into mainstream housing, as opposed to the stereotypical homeless person that's then portrayed. And they exist, that's why they're a stereotype. But as you say, there's a whole range of reasons that people end up as homeless.
Thank you. Brian.
Yeah, just following up on that same point. I mean, I think there's a big demand for studio flats or one-bedroom accommodations, and you see that demand, and we should maybe be thinking more outside the box on it as well. We can all identify different places that maybe would be suitable in our own localities, but I would prefer that to be mixed. You know, not just a homeless person's unit as such, because of the stigma and the possible neighbour objections and stuff like that that it would generate. But you know, a student flats that are available for homeless people as well, even if it's delivered by one of your partners, you know, in a housing association or a different kind of model. But we should really be trying to explore all these avenues to help identify, you know, or to reduce the need of homelessness accommodation.
Yeah, I would just certainly reassure you, we do look at every opportunity, as I hope to try to convey, and certainly we're compelled to do that with changes in terms of welfare reform. Us as a council being the direct provider is no longer going to be tenable. We've seen the results of that through the Orchard and Shipman contract already, and there's more of that to come in terms of closing down the prospects for us. Yeah. Direct delivery of these, and we are having discussions as well as look at opportunities with partners to do so. Yes.
Provost.
Yeah, I think we have to address this homeless attitude of people that have already got homes of their own. And I think we should be educating our people out there that you're right, that there aren't any homeless as in the sense of dosing all over the place, and that people do become homeless for various reasons through marriage breakup or whatever. And I think it's imperative on this council to try and get out there to the people, because we're getting a problem already. One of the premises you said you just bought with people kicking up, we didn't want somebody to come along here with a needle and ball and chains and their ankles staying next door to us. And we have to get there and educate people that homelessness isn't a crime.
Okay. Certainly, we continue to do that. I mean, we do that through our school education programme. We're in every school in Midlothian. And it's in order to give that context, but also in terms of making sure people have housing options when they leave school, when they're coming out of prison, whatever circumstances they find themselves in. And indeed, yes, I spent Monday night with a community who had undue concerns about our purchases of properties across Midlothian. But we continue to do that. It's part of that engagement. It's part of that education. That's what my job is, and that's what we need to continue to do about how we address homelessness. Because, yeah, what's the alternative? What else would you want me to do with your homeless people in Midlothian is the challenge back to these communities, I'm afraid. And we've made every effort to make sure that people remain in their communities from which they become homeless in. Because certainly, as you've experienced as members, your communities are not particularly happy when I export people within Midlothian because they don't have the opportunities or chances to remain in their communities about where our spread of temporary accommodation is, let alone previously, as Councillor Emery has referenced, that we used to export them out with Midlothian when we didn't have that direct provision here. So we continue to do that, absolutely, every opportunity.
Okay. Right, Kevin, thank you for that. We'll move on now to 4.4, Children's Services. Joan.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. As you can see from the report, we're almost at the end of our Children's Services review, and on Friday we announced the draft new structure to staff. So I'm sure as members can appreciate this has taken up a huge amount of time in relation to trying to maintain that staff are motivated and also trying to alleviate some of the fears that the rumours are having in the Children's Services at this moment in time. Obviously, the new structure is confidential at this moment in time, but I'm convinced that the new structure will provide a much more efficient service. I think once we get over the actual physical structure, then I think the real hard work begins in relation to changing the way that we do business and how we're going to have a much more joined-up service in relation to working with our partner agencies, the voluntary sector, the faith groups, etc., as we go forward. I will keep people abreast of that. We have been selected by the Permanence and Care Excellence Programme, the PACE Group as it's known, in relation to our permanence framework. That was supposed to start this month, but due to the service review, we've agreed to postpone that until January 2017, when staff hopefully will be in their new positions and ready to take forward this piece of work. It's been 2 years in the making, and it's no Children's Services that have only done that. We've had assistance from Business Services and, more importantly, from our Legal Services as well in relation to getting a framework that any new member of staff can walk into Children's Services and know what happens from the point that they're getting ready to accommodate a child. And it's been a huge achievement and a very, very large piece of work going forward. And because of the legislation, etc., it's a piece of work that continues to change. But the ultimate outcome is that we are placing children far quickly than we've ever placed children before. Hence, we now have a surge in relation to requiring many adoptive placements. But that's a good place to be rather than where we used to be before. So children are getting their positive outcomes much, much quicker. We've fully embedded the outcome-focused Stage 2 assessment, and that's on the back of self-directed support, which is just a normal way of working now, but obviously is a key piece of legislation that came in 2014, and we're now testing it out on our Stage 3, which is the child protection looked after work. Again, we need assistance from our legal teams because these reports do go to court, they go to children's hearings, and they're up for a huge amount of scrutiny and challenge, so we need to make sure that these reports, whilst staff and everybody else wants them to be a lot shorter and more detailed, that they do have the substance in them that is going to meet that legal challenge when we're further down the line if we're getting ready for a young person to be adopted or something like that. So that's another ongoing piece of work that's getting taken forward. As Grace alluded to, the named person has been put on hold. Business as usual is happening in Midlothian, and that is no huge concern in relation to ensuring that children are still safe, etc. And once we get further guidance from Scottish Government, we'll be able to take forward plans that are just sitting on hold at this moment in time. Our looked after at home and our looked after away from home remain below the Scottish average and have done for almost 2 years now, which is a good place to be. Our child protection has slightly increased, and I can report today I think there's 46 children on the register, which is slightly above the Scottish average. My own sense from a head of service point of view is I think that we do sit at the 40 mark. We still have large families that go in the register within Midlothian, so we can get 6 coming off one day but 8 going on the next day, and that can just be one family. But I mean, it's certainly scrutinised enough in relation to the Public Protection Office, you know, hold monthly three quarterly meetings in relation to looking at our stats, and there is nothing that's saying that we're out of kilter, and certainly as head of service I'm comfortable with these stats that we have at this moment in time. The Vulnerable Young Persons Protocol is now up and running, and this has been a huge piece of work coming from the public protection team and multi-agency in relation to managing the young people within our communities, mainly teenagers, I would hasten to add, who didn't actually come under the child protection arena, because it's not a child protection concern in relation to someone doing something to them. It's the risk that they're placing upon themselves in relation to drug taking or alcohol misuse and things like that. So we have a protocol in place which is supporting us to manage this risk across all agencies, so it's not just children's services that sit with this. The challenges, as ever, the service review in itself is a challenge in relation to keeping staff motivated, but hopefully Friday we will start moving forward in relation to that. Finances, as everyone's alluded to, you know, whilst we've done this review, we now need to go into another review to look at what cuts we can make in addition to what we've already made within this review. And that's an ongoing piece of work. And as I say, the named person remains a challenge at this moment in time, although I'm sure that will work itself out once we get further guidance. And we continue to implement the other areas of work in relation to the Children and Young People Scotland Act 2014 in relation to kinship. We have a new part-time team leader, two part-time social workers. We now have a development plan in place, and twice a year I will have an overview of that development plan to look at the training and the support that we can continue to offer our kinship care going forward. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Russell, could we be a wee bit direct, please?
Aye, right, direct, aye, right, fine. Is that for everybody, including yourself? Aye, right, OK. No, the question I was going to ask, general question, adverts on the radio just now regarding children's panels, you know, wee Johnny goes out, tears his coat, hope dad's not back in, you know, sneaks in, father's there, or so-and-so gets back in, doesn't get to... you know, hopes that don't get a meal, so they have to go out looking for that, and then it kicks into the, you know, this is where I come and I sit on the children's panel. Now, that's a general advert put out in Scotland. Are we having any problems in filling places on the children's panel in Midlothian? Because all the hard work that you guys do on one end, if it can't go through the system, there's a blockage. I just wondered.
Service managers meet with the convener of the children's panel and two of the panel members once a month, and with the children's reporter, authority reporter, to iron out any problems or anything like that. We don't have problems recruiting people within Midlothian, I'm glad to add. In fact, I used to be a social worker many years ago within Midlothian, and there's still many panel members that sit on the panel then that are there today, which is good and bad, because we also need change as well. But no, I'm not aware of any difficulties within Midlothian. We've always had a good uptake.
Okay, no other questions, thank you. You're getting off in a short straw today. You can tell it's 25-1. Okay, if we move on to the final item for this morning, is Communities and Economy. Ian.
Thanks, Chair. The report's there for members to see, and I won't slavishly go through it all, because if there's any questions, then obviously I'm happy to pick up and amplify and answer on those. What I thought I'd probably do is just touch on two broad areas, which relates to the service itself, in as much as there's the strategic element of this service, and there's also the day-to-day provision of regulatory and development services. And it's the way in which we interact with those two and the way in which we can, as a fairly small part service of the council, then provide the sort of platform for other services and for trying to address some of the issues which are coming out from the single Midlothian plan. Just four things I want to pick up on in strategic side of things. Local development plan is now, as you know, approved by Council for submission to Scottish Ministers. We're expecting the examination into the unresolved objections to be later this autumn into the winter, and ultimately for adoption of the plan in spring, summer next year. And that is a plan for both, well, really for a 10-year programme, but particularly for the first 5 years. And it's planning for economic growth, for meeting housing need, for preserving and enhancing natural and heritage resources. It's also the land use agenda for the council, so it becomes a pretty significant document as a base. Just looking at other things. The Borders Rail Line, yes, it's got its first anniversary, and that's a point for celebration. Members have referred quite reasonably to some of the issues in terms of the operational end of things, and you heard from the Chief Executive on that. I noticed it was in the news yesterday in terms of BBC half 10. There was an item on it which I thought was fairly well balanced. But in terms of what the effort is, in terms of here, it's supporting economic growth. It is capitalising on that, that new line coming forward. And there is a window to try and do so whilst it's still in the public eye. And really, the essence of that is to have a big push at this time with a fair bit of external funding from the Blueprint Group, which looks after the Borders Rail Line, takes that forward in terms of its impact on the economy. So external funding for master planning work at Newton Grange and also in the Scottish Borders area, external funding for tourism development projects, that's come from Scottish Enterprise and from Visit Scotland. Allied to that, there is the Blueprint Fund group of some £10 million, which is being carefully looked at, and there are opportunities for bidding for schemes in Midlothian, which every expectation will come forward. This includes refurbishment of key buildings in the station areas at Gorebridge and Newton Grange, also public realm improvements as part of the wider Gorebridge work, town centre works up at Hunter Square. We've got a project there which I really hope will be very good. So Borders Rail is still high on the agenda, and it's one where there is external funding to actually make a difference. City Deal, or to touch on, is the third of the four items. There's no City Deal as yet, but post-Brexit, the anxieties seem to have been dispelled. Certainly the discussions which the team having with civil servants and with ministers, I understand, or through them to ministers, in relation to the UK government stance and Scottish government stance, is that it's still very positive. Both governments are very positive about about city deals and for a city deal for the Edinburgh City region. Again, the importance of that in a difficult financial climate is additional public money. It's probably a £2 billion deal, the majority of which would be funding from the central UK and Scottish governments for infrastructure projects, for projects related to skills, employability, digital, further rollout of broadband coverage, tourism, culture, housing, especially a focus on accelerating housing growth for affordable housing, new low-carbon communities. And the catchphrase for City Deal is accelerating growth, and that's the important thing about using the money for that. When bids are going in, and when the final bid goes through to the two governments, and it's going to have to be far more detailed than the sort of bidding documents that went up for Glasgow, because they're learning from experience about this. So business cases for projects are going to have to be pretty well sorted. But one of the big questions comes from government is, well, wouldn't you just do this anyway with your own money? And the important thing is to really stress the significance of why it's the added value of what comes in from government to accelerate economic growth. Fourth element I wanted to pick up on of strategic nature, but slightly more focused, is town centres. I've just mentioned briefly that there is master planning work going to be kicked off at Newton Grange. Let me also say that right at the beginning of the process is going to be the engagement with community council, community groups, and there is an arrangement already in place for Mary Smith and others to attend at Newton Grange Community Council in the coming weeks as a starting point for getting off on the right foot with the local community in terms of taking that forward. Gorebridge, the cars scheme is now pretty well advanced, and there has been additional money come in because of the success of that, because we have still people trying to and wanting to do work on buildings, so that's really good. And the Borders Rail Line money, we're expecting to come in and assist both with the station and with the Hunter Square public realm developments. And of course, we've just put in bids to the Lottery and to Historic Environment Scotland for what would be a £3.5 million or £3.8 million scheme for Pennycook Town Centre, very similar to the approach which was adopted for Dalkeith Town Centre and which finished in 2014. Four big projects that are all interrelated, and the whole reasoning behind that is because, you know, to improve the economy of Midlothian. So where we're trying to support many of the other heads of service who you've talked about with their services, my own view is that unless you've got economically healthy communities, you don't have communities that work. So simple things like a wage coming in, a less dependency on benefits, opportunities for training and apprenticeships, opportunities to get higher paid jobs are all at the heart of bringing money into communities, and that's the money which then you can start to see in terms of retail premises, commercial premises, an environment which is far more attractive and where people want to be and want to live. As part of the remainder of the service, I wanted to pick up on the fact that four out of the six elements of communities and economy are the regulatory and development services. It's planning, building standards, environmental health, trading standards. Planning has just undergone a full review, cost neutral, I would add, in relation to being far more focused and proactive and customer responsive. Building standards has retained and enhanced its customer service excellence external badge, and also its investors in people, and is now augmented its services through moving on to e-building standards, which is a national scheme from funded by the Scottish Government primarily, but we're in the vanguard of that. We're now fully staffed with the Environmental Health Service, which is just as well, given the demands that are being placed upon it. And we're now embedding the Trading Standards Partnership with East Lothian Council, not to make lots of savings, but to provide a much better service across a full range of transport of trading standards responsibilities across the two council areas. If I had to pick out one area which is really a focus at the minute, and it's probably the Economic Development Service, that is now undergoing review. You'll see from some of the figures in here, I'm concerned about performance on Business Gateway. That does not mean I have people clamouring to my door saying they're not getting the right advice or they can't get hold of anybody, but I just think presently the way in which we are delivering Business Gateway could be improved. I think we've had some difficulties in relation to staffing issues, etc., but leaving that all aside, it's an area which is of prime significance, I think, in terms of the economic development agenda, and it's one which I'm working on as part of a bigger look at the way in which we deliver economic development and we support both services within the council and communities in relation to that. Otherwise, Chair, happy to take whatever questions.
Thank you, Ian. Questions or comments for Ian? Brian.
The EU Leader Programme. What commitments have we got on the finances to this just now, even if it's just proposals, you know, that has been ring-fenced? Because my concern is, you know, use it or lose it, you know, kind of stuff with the current political climate and Brexit. And also, can that be used as match funding with the Borders Rail blueprint monies? And what size of fund is the blueprint money, and when's it likely to expire?
The information we're getting on LEADER programme, and as part of the wider EU funding programmes, is that in summary, we initially had very good assurances that up to the end of 2018 they were confident, and I think that was all about the two-year exit period. Now, the more recent guidance we're getting is that it looks as if it would be safe up to 2020. Now, LEADER programme finishes in 2020, so my simple hope and expectation is that the allocation of funds through LEADER is secure. I think any new programmes are going to run into issues in relation to what's happening with the wider exit of Britain from the EU. But the expectation is at the present time that we're not going to see a loss of LEADER allocated funding. So, but I'll need to update as we get further information through Scottish Government on that. In relation to match funding, I don't see any difficulties with match funding in terms of applications to Borders Rail Fund. If, in fact, as part of the bid, bidders can say or councils can say, look, we've actually got other money coming in, excellent. I mean, that's just seen as grist to the mill. In relation to the Borders Rail Blueprint Fund, that was initially a £10 million figure, which was announced by the former First Minister when he was speaking about the Borders Rail. It is new money into the area. It's effectively, as I understand it, rebadged and transferred money out of Scottish Enterprise, but in a sense, it's still public money coming into the area. So from that point, that's good news. It is administered by, and the decisions on it are made by the Blueprint Group, and the Blueprint Group comprises the three councils, that's Edinburgh, ourselves, Borders, Visit Scotland, Transport Scotland, Scottish Government and Scottish Enterprise, and they have the decisions on what projects they approve or not approve. So there's no other interference on that. The timing of the money, it does not have to be spent by a particular time. What's happening at the present time is that there are inevitably some projects which got, a bit of a push early on through the actual, through the First Minister's statement, former First Minister, which was about a home for the Tapestry and for Tweed Bank Business Centre. So there was some identification of projects which were going to be well up the queue in that. However, there's still a substantial amount of that funding to be allocated. There is a clear understanding there needs to be some fairness in terms of it being allocated the full length of the line. And I think that fairness really extends to the two council areas. We've not got Edinburgh wanting and waving the flag and saying we must have money. In essence, it's Borders and Midlothian. What's critical, I think, for Midlothian is we have a number of projects getting towards the stage where we can put them in for formal approval. We've got a target of the next meeting in December of the Blueprint Group to try and see if we can get at least two or three of the key projects up. The Blueprint Group's expecting to see them come up. We're well advanced, as I say, on two or three items, and we would like to do that. So that's where we are with those.
Ian?
Thanks, Eric. I'll keep this brief because I know we're pressed for time. My pet subject, broadband. Now, I think we've all been disappointed at the way BT has operated over the last few years, and I'll not go into that, but the latest development is that Virgin Media seem actually interested in coming out to Midlothian. Now, I asked them about 15 years ago, and they said it just wasn't economically viable. Obviously, we've got lots of new housing estates now. The economic performance of Midlothian is improving, and it's now of interest to them. Is there anything we can do to encourage competition like that? Because I think that's what BT needs, is some competition to stir them into action. Can we help companies like Virgin Media to make it easier for them to incorporate infrastructure into Midlothian?
Yeah, I know that the rollout of the major government-related one eventually boiled down to just one bidder, which was BT Openreach, and in a sense that was it. It was their bat and ball. The short answer is I'll take that back. I'm not fully cited on it. I will take it back, and I'll come back and make sure I inform you on that.
Thanks, Ian. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you for your attendance, Ian. Thank you for the report.